Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
My name is Craig Call, and I'm pleased to chair this session and to briefly introduce Dr. Browning. Gary and I are friends. We've been associated together for 10 years or so. Began with common church service jobs on Brigham Young University campus in Provo. And so I'm doubly honored to be here, not only because I respect him from an intellectual point of view and because of his academic credentials, but also because I know him to be a fine fellow and a good friend. I certainly will. Thank you. Gary Browning completed his undergraduate work at Brigham Young University in Russian. He then studied at Syracuse, where he received a master's degree in Harvard for his PhD, both of those in Slavic language and literature. He's been 9 times to the Soviet Union, and 2 of those times he's been there for periods of 6 months. And one of the things we've most enjoyed as a friend is to visit with him after those trips and see the depth and breadth of his insights and experiences in the Soviet Union. He has been dean of the honors program at BYU and also chairman of the Faculty Advisory Council. Those sorts of things don't come easy, and they speak very well of his talents. He now is chairman of the German and Slavic Languages Department. Dr. Browning.
Well, I'm delighted to be here and looking forward to the exchange that we'll have as soon as I make my formal presentations. As with each of you, there have been moments when my mind and spirit have been transported from the mundane to the unforgettably extraordinary and even sublime. I've experienced this transcendence while gazing at desert islands, cliffs, and ocean in Maine's Acadia National Park, and at the Delicate Arch in Utah, while admiring Thomas Cole's four-painting Voyage of Life allegory in Washington, D.C.'s National Art Gallery, and Andrew Wyeth's Boy with Chestnuts in Brandywine, Pennsylvania, while standing transfixed in the pre-Christian Pantheon in Rome and in Notre Dame in Paris. While watching a brilliant performance of Death of a Salesman or Three Sisters, while viewing Tarkovsky's Andrei Rublev or Bergman's The Magic Flute, while reading a book like Don Quixote or The Brothers Karamazov, while contemplating the archetypal richness of the Madonna and St. George images, while considering the human and spiritual greatness of Mother Teresa and Spencer W. Kimball, while listening to Stravinsky and Shostakovich, while contemplating 1 Corinthians 13 and section 121 in the Doctrine and Covenants, thinking also of great ideas like, I teach my people correct principles and they govern themselves. Let him who is without guilt cast the first stone. Jung's acknowledgement of the terrible ambiguity of the immediate experience in human life. We've just had one of these last night with the execution of Selby. Suddenly this was an immediate experience that seems to have resonances far beyond what many people had expected. P.A. Christensen's assertion that tragedy rises to realization in human experience not when hearts break in human relations, but when man discovers or suspects he discovers that the objects or values of his ultimate concern, his deepest solicitude, have no status or being in the texture of reality. And Dostoevsky's conviction that humans are made for happiness, and anyone who is completely happy has a right to say to himself or herself, I am doing God's will on earth. All of these phenomena and many others have enriched my life immensely, and I'm profoundly grateful that I've become aware of and influenced by them. But I've not yet mentioned by far the greatest of these influences. It is, of course, the Sermon on the Mount. Here, the firstborn of God, our elder brother, Savior of the world, teaches the eternal truths that lead to the perfection of God's and prepare us for celestial life. It is understandable that many people may wonder how seriously Christ intended these teachings, for in the sermon he preaches turning the other cheek. However, 5 chapters later, he asserts, I came not to send peace, but a sword. Although anyone reading Matthew 10 in context should recognize that Christ here speaks figuratively of those who, by accepting him, abandon the lesser traditions of their fathers and unintentionally but frequently cause tension and hostility, especially within their own families. In that specific context, again, figuratively, they bring not peace but a sword. Still, doesn't Christ contradict the sermon when he twice violently cleanses the temple of money changers and thieves? My own unscholarly and personal hypothesis is that there were not two cleansings, but one. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, apparently using a common literary source, place the event during Passover in the last week of the Savior's earthly ministry. John, now considered by certain scholars to be the most historically reliable of the gospel writers, also locates the cleansing during Passover, but in the very beginning of Christ's ministry, immediately after the first miracle of changing water into wine at Cana. I claim no prescience on this matter, but I want to believe John. To me, it seems possible, consistent, and logical that Christ's righteous indignation, here undeniably manifest in violence against his offenders, may have provided the experience for him to learn once more, line upon line, precept upon precept, in this case, that the higher law of resist not evil with force, soon to be spoken in the sermon, is generally the preferable course. The Savior certainly observes this teaching in praying at the end that his Father forgive his executioners, for they knew not what they were doing. Some wonder whether the sermon really is at the core of Christ's teachings. After all, Mark and John do not even include it in their Gospels. This is one fundamentally important area in which we Mormons have the greater advantage and responsibility. Only readers of and believers in the Book of Mormon know that Christ appeared to the worthy few on this continent after his crucifixion near Jerusalem. His time here was extremely brief. The writers of the Book of Mormon focus on the very most important events and messages of this historic occasion: baptism by priesthood authority, the sacrament, several prophecies and clarifications, and I believe most significantly, the Sermon on the Mount. I emphasize most significantly because, for instance, merely knowing the correct name of the church does not save one celestially, and baptism and other essential ordinances can be performed in a few hours, but it takes a lifetime or more to change our very natures to the point that we can consistently avoid anger and lustful thoughts, let alone sincerely love and pray for our enemies. Yet to live in the celestial kingdom, we must learn to do so naturally and always. What the Book of Mormon can do for us is to help us understand that of all the recorded teachings of Christ, those he himself considered most essential were contained in the Sermon on the Mount. The sermon was not merely an exercise in rhetoric, in utopian idealistic musing, or in theological speculation. The sermon is the only way to become perfect, even as Christ and our Father are perfect. Pursue any other values alone, beauty, power, wealth, worldly acclaim, wisdom, and by we will inevitably reap disappointment. With this second Sermon on the Mount, Christ takes all the uncertainty out of the question of where his priorities and counsel for us, his brothers and sisters, lay. We really do not have to wonder whether we are to follow peace or the sword, or, it seems to me, whether we should more eagerly and imaginatively pursue peace through strength or peace through love. For us Mormon Christians, much confusion should have been removed. This does not mean that following the teachings of the sermon is easy or natural. But our gaze has been fixed on a precise, although far more difficult, range of values. We will make mistakes, many of them. We'll fail over and over. But we cannot pretend that we do not know where our way must be. Michael Hart has written a book entitled The 100 Most Influential Men. And it is men, I'm sorry. He lists Muhammad first because he was an impressively influential religious, secular, and even military leader. Next comes Newton, the father of modern science. Only in third place do we find Jesus Christ. Hart says Christ's really distinctive teachings in the Sermon on the Mount are truly revolutionary. And if Christ's followers had been significantly influenced by them, he would list Christ first without hesitation. But unfortunately, when one carefully examines reality, we see that the teachings have actually had a rather slight influence on Christian humankind. This reminds me of William Booth's aphorism, "It's not that Christianity has been tried and found wanting, it has been found difficult and left untried." Perhaps Christianity can be partially excused because, as I have acknowledged, the New Testament is in places enigmatic and seemingly contradictory. But can we, who call ourselves Mormons, or Latter-day Saints, take refuge in the same rationalization? I believe not. The Book of Mormon has given us a second and decisive witness for Christ and his teachings. Distortions arising from inadequate translations, intentional changes by scribes or otherwise corrupted materials, should play virtually no role in our understanding. In fact, as far as the sermons are concerned, the two are virtually identical. There are differences, some significant, such as the change from the Matthew phrase, "Whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment," which appears in the Book of Mormon, minus the words "without a cause." Apparently, these three little but immensely important words were added at some point to the New Testament Gospels, perhaps by a well-meaning but fundamentally misguided individual who understood human nature but did not fully fathom Christ's sermon. If the Sermon on the Mount stands at the very center of our religious understanding, should it not inform and shape human behavior on every level? In relation to our own selves, to our spouses and families, neighbors, colleagues, and eventually to all humankind. Surely, since the sermon is God's word, it is applicable not only among one's kin and tribe, but also among peoples and governments. Its range encompasses not only theological realms, but also ethical and even political. For these reasons, among others, I was gratified to come across this book recently, "Peace is Possible: The Politics of the Sermon on the Mount," by Franz Alt, A-L-T. Its author insists that the sermon does possess fundamental political relevance. I agree. Let's recall some of the sermon's salient features that might also be applied to governmental, that is, political relations. Imagine with me a President Reagan and a General Secretary Gorbachev moved by these perspectives and imperatives. "Blessed are not the arrogant and chauvinistic, but the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Whosoever is angry with his brother shall be in danger of the judgment. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Judge not that ye be not judged. Why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own eyes? Not every one that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven." Interestingly, as an aside, in this book, Franz Alt actually prints the entire Sermon on the Mount. suggesting, I think, to me at least, and I could be wrong, of course, that there must be a lot of people that are not familiar with the Sermon on the Mount in his country of Germany, where the book was published, and that he felt a need to provide the sermon here. He prints it without commentary, but of course he does add his perspectives later. Franzal maintains that these and related principles do not obtain in either superpower, nor in any other nation of the world. Why? Says Alt. Because politicians feel themselves to be Christians in their private lives, but do not know how to bring Jesus of Nazareth into politics. Their faith in him is sentimental. Politically, they consider him a fool. He's good only for Sunday sermons and Christmas speeches. Alt explains further, in current political debate, we find the fiercest resistance to loving enemies. I can understand this resistance, if only because that was what I was saying and writing just a few years ago. That's not part of politics. That's daydreaming. That's naive. That's pure utopia. Since then, I have come to realize that I did not understand Jesus. If you put down love of enemies as a crackpot notion, you should at least be honest with yourself and admit that you're calling Jesus a crackpot. In his introduction, Alt admits that, quote, in 1981, I believed that NATO had to keep up the arms race. Today, I consider it lethal. The reasons for my change of heart are described in this book. It will take you 4 hours to read it. During these 4 hours, the world will spend something like $250 million on arms. At the same time, 7,000 children will starve to death. As far as the sermon is concerned, quote, Christians and Christian churches, although about to enter the third millennium, third Christian millennium, are still living as in pre-Christian days. And, quote, we still have Gethsemane 2,000 years later, Jesus denied and in danger of being nailed to the cross, and his followers asleep. Yes, indeed, we ourselves keep crucifying him in every starving child with our every act of violence, even private violence, and with the billions we spend on armaments. Close quote. A large part of the reason is that, quote, many Christians today believe more in the power of the bomb than in the power of the Sermon on the Mount. The politics of the bomb is a God is dead politics. The Sermon on the Mount confronts us with a choice, God or the bomb. You cannot serve two masters, God and the bomb, peace and preparations for war. Building atomic assault weapons is modern paganism. Even if responsible politicians, scientists, and military men zealously claim to be Christians. Close quote. This last thought is clearly and stirringly expressed in Spencer W. Kimball's bicentennial address entitled The False Gods We Worship, published in the June 1976 Ensign. I have a feeling that all of you are familiar with this, I know, just looking from my friends in the audience. But once more, may I repeat it? It's a wonderful statement. We are a warlike people, easily distracted from our assignment of preparing for the coming of the Lord. When enemies rise up, we commit vast resources to the fabrication of gods of stone and steel, ships, planes, missiles, fortifications, and depend on them for protection and deliverance. When threatened, we become anti-enemy instead of pro-kingdom of God. We train a man in the art of war and call him a patriot. Thus, in the manner of Satan's counterfeit of true patriotism, perverting the Savior's teaching that we love our enemies. We forget that if we're righteous, the Lord will either not suffer our enemies to come upon us, or he will fight our battles for us. What are we to fear when the Lord is with us? Can we not take the Lord at his word and exercise a particle of faith in him? Our assignment is affirmative, to forsake the things of this world as ends in themselves, to leave off idolatry and press forward in faith, to carry the gospel to our enemies that they might no longer be our enemies. Close quote. Like the Sermon on the Mount, these remarkable words have had very little effect on us who claim to be Latter-day Saints. Spencer W. Kimball and Franz Alt recognized that in the sermon, Christ was asking for no less than a new man. In Alt's words, so far, all revolutions have proved that one cannot create a new man. Yet Jesus wants the new human being. However, this new human being can only come from within us. The failure of all socialist revolutions is due to the socialist belief that human beings can be changed if conditions on the outer, material human being are changed, naturally under pressure and coercion. The results are well known. Human beings cannot be changed. Human beings can only change themselves. This wrenching change toward the ethics and politics of the Sermon on the Mount is excruciatingly difficult, but it alone is what will allow us eventually to become perfect. The major problem, I believe, is that many are convinced that the teachings of the sermon are ineffectual when it comes, for instance, to the communists. We often hear comments like, "Communists don't accept the sermon, so neither can we." Or, "Turning the other cheek to them just gets you two sore cheeks." Or, "Remember what happened to the early pacifist Christians. They were thrown to the lions." The following paraphrase of a commonly encountered image is used to illustrate the point that one cannot take the "love your enemy" or even "let us reason together" approach with the Russians. Suppose you were to come upon a burly thug beating up a defenseless woman. Would you merely request politely that he stop, or would you intercede on behalf of the poor lady? Would you use force if necessary? If struck, would you contritely turn the other cheek, or expect that the victim absorb blow after blow without complaining and without your intervention? And again, because of the events of last night, we might ask ourselves if we had come up into the hi-fi shop in Ogden 13 years ago, what would we have done? One often encounters variations of this scenario. Suppose a killer were to attack your wife and children, or husband and children. Or suppose the Good Samaritan had come along the road a little earlier while the brigands were robbing and beating their victims, or their victim, etc., etc. Or in this fallen world, in this fallen world, the U.S. regrettably must use force to combat evil, the USSR, for that is the only language evil understands. It is our solemn and inescapable moral duty to prevent the communists from crushing religion, every weaker nation, and its own dissidents in its relentless pursuit of world domination. Close quote. On the surface, these are compelling, although largely emotional, arguments for our usual governmental policy. Those who attempt to counter it are portrayed as wimps, naive, and even dangerous. To illustrate the point most forcefully, those who advocate fighting fire with fire frequently refer to families where husbands have a timeless responsibility to defend, physically if necessary, their children and wives. There, I think we all agree, if someone attacks one's wife or children, one must repulse the attacker. If the only alternative were to kill the aggressor to prevent him from murdering your wife, then that, in my judgment, too must be done. But even here, more options than one may be available. On some occasions, it may be also possible to wound or otherwise restrain the offender. And I assume that for a Christian, this latter alternative would be preferable. But let us remember, a person may assault another for various reasons. The aggressor might indeed be wanton and depraved, one who simply craves killing. This type is very rare, but the most dangerous. He is virtually or even literally irrational, or perhaps insane. Logic will not work with him. Fair play, cooperation, respect, and kindness are of no use. In these relatively rare instances, the use of force seems unavoidable to prevent harm to innocent victims. I can't imagine, however, even in a situation like this, that we would anticipate with glee or celebrate, let's say, the death of another individual. On the other hand, the attacker is usually far less maniacal. It could be that Only out of desperation does he use violence to achieve purposes he considers essential. In this case, he would still have to be restrained, but it might be possible at some point to reason with him, to provide incentives and a role model that would help him to evolve into an acceptable member of society. It is always a risk to allow someone another chance. One could very easily be wrong, but one could also be successful. And it seems only appropriate for Christians to do all within their power to encourage positive change. There may even be further explanations why someone attacks another. For instance, in certain extreme cases, the attacker may be so fearful for his own safety that when another appears to threaten or invade his territory, he sees no other alternative than physical force to promote his own survival. Or the apparent victim may in fact be someone who has been mistreating or otherwise provoking the so-called aggressor for some time. This list of motivations could be continued, but suffice it to say that most human conflicts are very complex and require careful examination before rendering judgments. Perhaps I'm still left with the imperative to protect the weak and innocent victim, but I feel that I'm not justified in using more force than is necessary or in judging the aggressor as bestial or irredeemable without considerable reliable evidence and honest attempts to communicate clearly and behave fairly. How does all of this apply to the Soviet Union? In my view, the situation here is parallel, although even more complex. Now we're speaking of 282 million people with an evolving, not static, history and social experiment. The Soviet Union, I believe, was not exactly the same under Khrushchev, Brezhnev, Andropov, or Chernenko, nor is it the same under Gorbachev as it was under Lenin or Stalin. It is still our most formidable ideological and military opponent, but it is not now, nor has it been for nearly 35 years, in the clutches of a fanatic like Stalin or, in Germany, Hitler. But why is the USSR apparently so aggressive? Doesn't it have as a central goal world military domination? Yes, I believe the USSR would be pleased to acquire even greater power. If you gave her the world, she would take it gladly, as most likely would Libya, Iran, Israel, South Africa, Cuba, or even the United States. Yes, the Soviet Union desires the spread of communism. It wants more and more trading power, partners, and military allies. But in my opinion, Russia is not now able to engage in a comprehensive program of gobbling up every nation one by one. Its aggression, as we understand it, I believe, requires examination. The USSR is bordered not by two nations, as is the case with the United States, but by 12. Throughout her history, she's been attacked, and she's attacked also, repeatedly over these barrierless borders. From the east have struck numerous Oriental tribes and hordes, including the Golden Horde under Genghis Khan and his descendants. And from the west have come powerful invaders, especially the Napoleonic French and Hitler's Nazis. During World War II alone, over 20 million Soviets perished of disease, starvation, and bullets. By contrast, the United States has lost under one half of 1 million men in all the wars of this century. Hence, Russians are very deeply concerned about protecting their borders. We call them paranoid, and maybe to an extent they are. But it would likely seem different to us if on our two borders we had not the friendly nations of Canada and Mexico, but say, Iran and Libya. The Soviets have placed a very high priority on the formation of a buffer zone of friendly, in quotation marks, or at least non-hostile nations around the borders of the USSR. Hence, Soviet heavy-handedness in East Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, Yugoslavia, and Bulgaria at the end of Second World War. And hence the 1979 invasion of Afghanistan, which borders three of the 15 Soviet republics. Before the Soviet invasion, Afghanistan had been Marxist following a coup, but was on the verge of, quote, falling to powers more sympathetic to the West. the Soviet Union would not tolerate a deterioration of security on her borders. She will allow neutral countries like Finland or Austria, but is especially hostile to the idea that any one of her border nations that has been considered in her orbit should change its course 180 degrees. This she considers destabilizing and provocative. I do not agree with that, but that makes very little difference in the Soviet Union. We would do well to recall that another reason for this paranoia is the history of Western attempts to locate military bases, missiles, and intelligence gathering facilities in any of the 12 bordering nations that will permit such activity.
This is the end of Side 1.
True, we feel that the Soviets should not be so paranoid, but we've seen how concerned Americans are with the thought of additional Soviet influence in countries anywhere near our borders. Did I say Soviet Union? We've seen how Americans worry about any Soviet influence near us, for instance, in Grenada and Nicaragua. Although I may wish otherwise, I see little hope of ever compelling the USSR to withdraw its influence from the satellite border states. If, in our view, the Soviet Union is behaving as a thug to these nations, we can do almost nothing except howl unless we are prepared to fight another war, this one to the extinction of both sides and all peoples. It may be possible, however, to encourage more moderate Soviet behavior. I believe that the ethics and politics of the Sermon on the Mount provide a worthy model. In practical terms, what might U.S. policy to the Soviet Union look like if we followed the principles of the sermon? Surely our leaders' speeches would attempt to build bridges of understanding by considering events in their historical and current social context, to encourage and acknowledge ever more decent behavior, to avoid stereotypes and distortions, to restrain our inclination to belittle, denigrate, and humiliate. We would enter trade and arms reduction negotiations in a spirit of honesty, rigor, and fairness, trying to understand why the other side considers specific provisions important or repugnant, and avoiding subterfuge aimed at acquiring unilateral advantage. Considering the past centuries of conflict and suspicion, I don't advocate or expect precipitous and sweeping change. Rather, I urge small but constant steps, each of which is in harmony with the sermon. I approve of West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl's brand of realism, at least as expressed in the following sentiment: to create peace without weapons. This is an understandable wish, and it is also a highly dangerous illusion. To create peace only with weapons, this would be a deadly blindness. To create peace with fewer and fewer weapons, this is the mission of our time. And of course, it's Helmut Kohl who removed what appears to be the last obstacle to an INF agreement in Europe, elimination of medium-range nuclear missiles. However, for this to happen, I feel that we must come to believe in the power of the sermon's teachings, as did Gandhi. Today, he said, we are continually being astounded at the discoveries made in the area of violence, weapons. I can guarantee that far more astonishing and seemingly impossible discoveries can be made in the area of nonviolence. Close quote. Unfortunately, too many of us, Mormons, Latter-day Saints, believe that peace is a proverbial impossible dream, that wars are inevitable, and their numbers will only increase, regardless of what you or I, or, quote, tired diplomats, close quote, might try to do to prevent them. But I remind you of the First Presidency Christmas message of 1980. Quote, when there is enough of a desire for peace and a will to bring it about, it is not beyond the possibility of attainment. Close quote. 1 year later, the first presidency added, to all who seek a resolution to conflict, be it a misunderstanding between individuals or an international difficulty among nations, we commend the counsel of the Prince of Peace. Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. This principle of loving one another as Jesus Christ loves us will bring peace to the individual, to the home, and beyond, even to the nations and to the world. Close quote. Is it not time to unleash our creative and mental energies in the pursuit of the ethics and politics of the Sermon on the Mount? As Albert Schweitzer said, quote, certain truths have remained ineffectual for a long time only because the possibility that they could become realities was not taken into consideration. Should we who are Mormons and know the second testimony of and even by Christ not lead in the exploration of ways to implement the teachings of the sermon? Let others who do not have the same mandate and perspective consider and argue for alternative approaches, including peace through strength. Is it not a paradox that so many of us Mormons are among the most fervent in hating rather than in loving our enemies, in demanding a pound of flesh rather than turning the other cheek, and in relying on the arm of man rather than of God? How did this happen? Should it not change? We each here today could make a telling contribution if we would be willing gradually to turn away from our mountains of armaments and, figuratively, to ascend in our faith, ethics, and politics the mount on which the greatest sermon of all times was taught. Thank you. Now, I've left plenty of time for rebuttals or questions or additional considerations that we should spend maybe the next 10 or 15 minutes on. Do you wish to do that? Yes.
Yes, I have two tiny comments and one question. I love what you're saying. And I was just remembering, having been at the temple experience discussion yesterday, and I thought then, as I think now, wouldn't it be wonderful if we go there and listen to the Sermon on the Mount as we sit there in the building, and then they come to obey that and then go out.
I've had the same thought.
And also, it reminds me that Mormons have such faith in the Catholic. We know that we bring things about through our faith.
Self-fulfilling prophecies.
We really are giving our energy to something that we don't have to. But if we had enough faith in avoiding the Catholicism, we could do that. And my question is, have you had much negative response to the annual...
The Peace Symposium at BYU.
I know one woman who wrote a letter against it.
There have been the fact of the matter is that there's been a great deal of positive response to it, and some negative response, but rather little. But the difficulty in all of this is that negative response is quite almost vicious, I would say. And again, the difficulty that comes from all of this is quite often those who have the negative responses don't write to that committee organizing it or to any of the participants, but usually write to the president of the church and all of the 12 and then President Holland and all of his, you know, it comes down that way. And so it causes a great deal of anxiety and discomfort. And we have had the Peace Symposium. I mean BYU, and it's been sponsored by the students, student group called Response. They wanted to call themselves Students for Social Responsibility, but ended up with Response. And I think they do a wonderful job. And again, most response has been positive. Yes.
When you ask for another question,
go ahead.
Dr. Lynch,
well, Dennis, there are a lot to do, of course.
As you talked about, so I was thinking about the response to something I thought of now, we were talking about it. And one of the many impressions that I had when I visited was something being 2 years ago, a year and a half ago.
Good.
You mentioned, as you were talking about the Sermon on the Mount, the context of one executes all my books,
that's right.
And those who have visited the Soviet Union have probably had, in many instances, the same experience that I have had, where in Leningrad, on Nevsky Prospect, asking a woman how to serve two older women with shopping bags, and asking them how to communicate where I want to go, and then pointing, and then grabbing your arm.
You're
saying, no, I understand where it is,
yeah.
Don't worry about it, and then insisting on doing and didn't care walking through the subway and wanting to go through a certain address in the subway and not knowing exactly where the subway station was. And we saw four or five teenagers, these were kids, 16, 17 years old. Two boys, two girls, and asking them where the subway was, and they knew a little bit of English, and of course they, and then leaving again, and suddenly we realized they were behind us. Well, actually, they didn't know any English. They didn't know any English. But there was this the phenomenon of wanting
to talk.
But they just started walking with us. We couldn't talk back and forth at all, but we sensed that they wanted to show us where the subway station was. So we went, and when we got to the subway station, they got on the subway. And we went out 35 minutes on the subway, and they stood with us. And then, and we couldn't talk. We were just with them. And then we got off the subway, they got off with us, and got on the subway back into town and waited by. And I thought it was about someone going to play with you when you ask for a
good examples. And most people who have gone to the Soviet Union would gladly add to your list. I certainly could as well. Please. And then you, yes.
You're not quite giving me an alternative. I don't see it.
Okay.
When Gandhi went into a nonviolent solution, he had a clean alternative that had power. I object to the violence of the techniques that we use now, too.
Sure.
But we must have a legitimate alternative that has power. Gandhi had a clean system in which he knew how to work the bridge against himself, and he had this enormous body of people who were not very well united in amongst themselves, but very much united in trying to get the British out.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they could work the problem. They had this enormous resource and power base to work the problem of forcing the British out. Now, a new issue, United States versus the USSR. Where is the power base? What kind of buffer can be used? What kind of techniques are available? Let's have something clean and simple that we can align ourselves behind, and now you're getting close to doing something about it.
Are you talking about changing the government in the Soviet Union? Is that what you have in mind, or? Well, what is the problem you're posing, or is it for Eastern Europe, for instance, getting out of Eastern Europe, or?
Well, the first problem I would attack.
Right.
Is disarmament.
Right. Okay. Good. Well, I hoped you would say that, of course, because right now it seems to me we not only have a window but a barn door open of opportunity for disarmament talks. Our responsibility, it seems to me, is to be, as I'm sure you would agree, to be very, very well prepared and to be rigorous in our negotiations without compromising any of our important principles and without giving away the shop, certainly. try very hard to come to some kind of agreement with the Soviets. Clearly, they're in a position where they want to have agreements. They've made really an historical string of concessions. Now, of course, every time they make a concession, there are those among us who say, well, gee, if they're doing that, it must really be in their own interest, and somehow it's against us, and it will leave us less. Well, we have to make sure that we don't become defenseless. I agree with you. But on the other hand, right now would be a time for, I think, marshaling the finest minds in both countries, the most experienced people, the senior diplomats, and getting them all together in supernumerary conferences and putting whatever resource we can into moving these negotiations along while we can strike with that hot iron. Well, that's what I have in mind. I think it's Gorbachev talks about new thinking. He's referring to Einstein's comment that with the dropping of the first atomic bomb, everything changed except man's way of thinking. And he said, and Gorbachev is talking about the need for new thinking on every problem. And for that, I'm not sure that we can continue kind of the slow way that we have for so long. We need to have some brilliant new ideas and energetic people willing to explore them carefully, eyes wide open. I'm not talking about patting one another on the back and blinking our eyes and saying we forget about everything that went on, all will be fine. And no, we've got to be, if anything, more hard-nosed now in our thinking, but fair in our deliberations and imaginative. Now, you had a comment. And yes.
I'm troubled that Larry is not more involved in the peace movement.
Yes.
In fact, if one becomes involved in the peace movement, one becomes suspect.
That's right.
And I think that's partly because we're so tied in to American culture. You see, there's not too long ago, I had a friend from Pennsylvania, John Hofstadter.
Oh, yes.
He was visiting with me, and we passed the point of the mountain. And he said, what's that building there? I said, that's our state prison. In fact, I was taking him down to BYU for a lecture.
Yes.
And we started talking about...
I attended his lecture, by the way.
Oh.
Fine one.
I asked him about the death penalty. One of the Mennonites in the death penalty, we're opposed to the death penalty. I said, why? He said, because to acknowledge the death penalty as the best solution is to admit that Christ is not effective.
That there's no hope.
People in Utah say, kill him. You know, there's a great disjunction there. And the last few days I've been doing oral history for the Church of the British Mission. I've been reading all my own missionary journal in the 1950s. And in there, repeatedly I say, I'm writing comment to myself, the only solution to world peace is for people to accept the gospel. A simplistic perspective, of course. But the Amish and the Mennonites, their basic tenet is the Sermon on the Mount. That's the core of their religion. It's not the core of Mormonism, I'm afraid. We're much more institutional. We're less inclined to go that hard route, which I think we have to do. But I don't know how. I think more instead of how can we solve, how can we rush to solve the problem, how can we engender in Latter-day Saints more concern for the Sermon on the Mount and not be so damn pragmatic and say, well, we've got to watch the prophets come. Prophets come before the prophets.
Thank you for that. Judy, you have a...
This is not a really an idea that we want to do. It's an old idea that I think deserves to be in response to your question. And that is that... That we need to do more of what you did in 20 years ago. We ceased to a great extent the kinds of communications like you talked about that allow people to love one another. And so you talked about getting all diplomats together. And clearly, what needs to happen is that at every level of society, there needs to be an incredible amount of money committed to people touching one another's body, you know, like shaking hands.
Yes.
I mean, you were changed by going there.
That's right.
It's thought is partly your conversion, real conversion to the gospel. I don't think it's a conversion.
No, I agree with you.
Partly you're going there has made you so appreciative of this opposite, this alternative. And all of us seem to have more experience being influenced with people that we perceive to be the enemy because we have to forget that experience.
Yes.
My other question,
yes.
Is how do you avoid when you're talking to Mormons or not about using the term on the ground and model for political life? How do you avoid this driving things up with people saying, now, wait a minute, if you're going to start talking about what you just called it, you have license to, you know, new writings and all these things that are adding to the non start using their religion.
Well, I think you've put your finger on the very problem that discourages many people from talking about these issues, actually, because it's not only raising flags, but it's also words that you hear in your priesthood quorums and you hear from neighbors on your block and so forth. I finally come to the conclusion that I may be right to some extent, I may be wrong to in another dimension, but it's very important. In fact, it seems to me it's almost sacred responsibility we each have to say what we believe deeply and keep trying to say things more effectively. I learn each time from people who come up and say, well, gosh, that was really a very weak point that you made there, and I re-examine and try to do better where I can. I've listened to other people, and, again, this is the book that I wanted to write. I should have written, a Mormon should have written this book, Peace is Possible, The Politics of the Sermon on the Mount. Perhaps it's more effective that someone else did. But I'm just saying we should be, even if they were never published, it seems to me, we should be writing books like this and giving talks and exploring. Now, if we really believe that, and here we have two witnesses of the sermon, I think of all of the sermons the Savior must have given, all of the teachings that he provided, and yet from that grand store he selected the Sermon on the Mount. Seems to me that that ought to be enough of a clue to us that that's to be taken seriously, that we would have study groups and we would have priesthood manuals and we would have a great deal of effort directed at understanding and applying on an everyday basis, not the grand idealistic, someday maybe this will be applicable, but today, how can we actually apply it? I'm surprised that the Mennonites and the Quakers and a few others really are, seems to me, kingdoms ahead of us in their understanding of the Sermon on the Mount in some ways. Could well be wrong. I have been so often, but yes, go ahead. And then I'll come to you, Kent. Please, yes.
Two comments. Very briefly, because I agree with what you say in general, that it's going to lack qualifications.
Yes.
Our society is so tied in, the time kids are very small, it is using violence. Look at the stories, look at the culture we have created. Walking into a Kmart store and having 15 little kids surrounded with guns. So, absolutely incredible. Our watch the preparation for the new Christmas, and what a difference they're supposed to have if they are really with it. And the amount of money spent not per child on weapons of violence. All right, that is part of the social culture. Some people say, biologists would be a martyr, so basically aggressive.
Yes.
It's almost natural. We are just building on the natural instincts. And the dialogue culture here is a quite a and the love of guns, the love of playing, all the north out here in the forest, preparing for a great new attack,
Yes.
What happens is it relates to this. You've turned it very much on Russia, which I think, of course, very good right now. But I honestly believe that people love a president who will stand tall and who will find an enemy. And I think if Russia were to disappear from the earth, that it would not make people want to be less violent. Because if one looks just the last few years, the number of things we've been involved in, it has not all been involved. But we have something new we've never had before, and that is a military industrial complex who have an interest in keeping expenditures of arms high, in rallying support for industry and the American people, how many you are, all the great. So at least the argument seems very basic to me. And I wish that this moment try to understand this a little more. Because this is part of the context that we have to try to deal with what you have and if you want to do.
I think that's so helpful. Kent and then Jim. I'll come to you.
Twice in your talk, Gary, you made allusion to selfing.
No. Oh, I'll just say a sentence because I know others want to make comments as well. When you have a heinous crime like this, the natural instinct, it seems to me, is to want to punish someone. And yet, 13 years after the event, when, if you can believe what you're reading in the newspapers, there have been some changes in the man. What seems so simple then becomes quite complex. And then if you start saying to yourself, wait a minute, do I or do I not believe in the Sermon on the Mount? Then everything becomes very ambiguous. And I'm confronted with one of these immediate experiences that Jung talks about that are so disquieting and ambiguous. And I don't know, something doesn't seem quite right, and it especially seems very wrong to me when I read of people holding celebrations of his death. I guess at the very, very least, if he had to be executed, and I'm not convinced that that was the thing, then it should have been done with great sorrow, I suppose, that we had to come to this, that somehow everything failed, and this was what was necessary to preserve society, let's say. But to celebrate it, this morning we had an orientation session at BYU, and one person mentioned Selby's execution last night, and a few people applauded. And I've been thinking about that since then. Jim, and then we'll come to you, and then I think we have to finish.
Quakers don't go near.
Well, you remember what happened when President Kimball in priesthood meeting talked about problems of hunting. The very next day there was a clarification in the church which helped us realize that wasn't what he really meant to say after all. You have a comment? And oh, you did, okay.
Speaking of books, Dr. Scott said
I'm sorry I'm not, but it's a book that I want to read and intend to. Has anyone here? Or would you care to comment on it?
Well, he says that what we have to do to reach community, and he gives a blueprint for reaching community at step one, step two, step three,
yes.
Step four.
Yes.
And when you arrive, you know you have community. Mm-hmm. And community is being diversity. Community is acceptance.
Diversity.
Accepting a pluralistic society, a pluralistic world, making the best of it.
Thank you very much for your patience and for your good comments. I'll stay around if anyone has an additional point they'd like to make, and look forward to seeing you on other occasions as we talk again.
This is the end of this cassette.